Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, with more than 17,000 sites serving over 50 million Americans, community health centers meet a critical need for individuals and families who otherwise would not have access to affordable primary care. Also this morning in our Throwback Thursday segment, yes, the school supplies can add up and the clothes are expensive, but it is the technology that really gets you. We have strategies for managing those costs without breaking the bank from the experts at CNET Money. And looking to serve up something deliciously different on your plate or put a new spin on a family favorite? Taste what pork can do. We have some terrific recipe ideas. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, August 6th, 2026. We're 1 week away now. 1 week away from the first day of school for Findlay City School students. And I know most of the county schools have a little while longer yet. But back to school 1 week from today. And kids who are heading back to class are facing overload, and not just in the classroom. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, the average school backpack weighs over 15 pounds. 15 pounds! And that's way too heavy. And for you and I, 15 pounds, probably no big deal. But for young kids, that is way too much. The recognized safety limit is no more than 10% of your body weight. So that is where you should be, no more than 10%. And 15 pounds for, you know, I don't know too many elementary school students who are 150 pounds. So, you know, weigh that backpack and make sure that health officials say look for a backpack that has wide straps, the widest straps possible, to better distribute the weight on your child's back and limbs. Or they also suggest getting a backpack with wheels on it so that they don't always have to carry it. They can wheel it behind them to give your kids' shoulders a break. So something to keep in mind. We're sending the kids back to school. 15 pounds worth of stuff. Books and computers and, you know, all of that other stuff. 15 pounds. Wow. By the way, before the school year starts, a new poll suggests that you really do need to get out there with your kids and do something that they will remember. I hope that you have not let the entire summer slip away without doing something fun, something special, something memorable with your family. And here is the stat that I saw that drives the point home. A new Harris poll says 62% of adults remember family vacations from when they were between 5 and 10 years of age. Not only do they remember those vacations, they have fonder, more vivid memories of those family vacations from when they were between 5 and 10 years old, more vividly than any Christmas or birthday. You think that you always want to give kids a birthday to remember or a Christmas to remember. We seem to focus so much energy on that, but it is not the gifts, it's not the material things, it's not that. Those family vacations that they spend in the summertime with their parents, their siblings, those are the things that we all carry. Those are the memories that we carry deep into our adulthood. So if that doesn't drive the point home, if you have not gone out, done something special with your family, make some memories, you are running out of time to do that, but do that. So, back to school, autumn is right around the corner, football season is coming, and you might have seen this week. The Buckeyes are sitting in the top spot of the preseason coaches poll. It was released this week. Ohio State listed as the number one college football team in the nation in those coaches poll rankings. Ohio State number one. Oregon, also from the Big Ten, sitting at number two, with Georgia, Texas, and Notre Dame rounding out the top five. And in the entire top 25, the Big Ten has seven of their teams in the top 25. The SEC has 9 total teams in the top 25. Now, the reason I bring this all interesting, and all of that you may have already heard, all of that. But, and by the way, the preseason AP poll will be out August 17th, which I believe is a week from Monday, if I'm right on that. But anyway, you can check the calendar, August 17th. But here's why we bring it up. Before you get too excited about the Buckeyes being the preseason number one, know that in recent years, that designation has been more of a curse. Texas, you recall, was number one last year and missed the college football playoffs entirely. Georgia held the spot the year before, and they lost their first playoff game. The year before that, Georgia was again number one and missed the playoffs. The year before that, Alabama was number one and missed the playoffs. You kind of notice a pattern here of preseason number ones. In fact, since 2000, so in the 21st century, only two teams have started number one and then ended up winning the national championship. That was Alabama in 2017 and USC all the way back in 2004. So I'm not saying that Ohio State's season is already over, but it is not necessarily the honor that you may think it is. Maybe they can be the exception. I don't know. We'll see. They've got a tough schedule. This is a tough schedule this year. A lot of really big games and a lot of really big games on the road for the Buckeyes this year. So we'll see how it goes. Preseason number one, that's all great, but nobody's taken a snap yet. We'll see where things go. This day's news of most lasting significance may be this. A Tennessee lab has built a molecular light switch to control a brain protein linked to Alzheimer's disease. Scientists at Vanderbilt say that they have engineered a custom chemical tool that can switch off a protein called TAOK1 and then switch all three of the related proteins back on again. They can switch it off, they can switch it back on. These proteins have been associated with Alzheimer's, but scientists have lacked a way to test what these proteins actually do. So now they can switch them off, and they can do these tests, and they can switch them back on, do the test again. They can figure out what the difference would. So they will figure out, they would be able to figure out what these proteins do. Vanderbilt says these new tools could help save drug developers years in developing treatments, in building treatments for dementia and Alzheimer's. That is huge. It is huge. And if that's not today's news of most lasting significance, this could be a cancer-fighting chewing gum. That's right, you heard correctly. A cancer-fighting chewing gum developed at the University of Pennsylvania Dental School. It has been found to nearly eliminate human papillomavirus. That's the virus associated with head and neck cancer. Dr. Henry Daniel says this bioengineered gum cuts the HVP levels in the mouth by up to 93% and does not seem to harm beneficial bacteria. Gets rid of the bad stuff and leaves the good stuff alone. That raises hope, he says, for a safer and more affordable cancer-fighting therapy. How about that? How about that? We live in an incredible age, do we not? That is crazy. And while we are on the subject of saving lives, this may be one of the best ideas I have heard in a long time. I saw this story on the Newswire yesterday, and this was kind of a what I call a head slapper. And you hear this and you go, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't somebody think about this sooner? Tampa General Hospital in Florida, Tampa, Florida General Hospital is launching what they say is the nation's first drone program to deliver blood directly to the scene of an emergency. we keep hearing in the news, you know, Amazon's using drones to deliver products to people's doorsteps in a hurry. We've heard of, you know, I don't know, is it Domino's or somebody wants to use drones to deliver pizzas? Well, we can deliver pizzas and we can deliver, you know, Amazon to our doorstep via drones. It only makes sense that by extension, we could deliver life-saving blood for a transfusion right at the scene of an emergency. The initiative is developed with the Hillsborough County Fire Rescue and several other corporate partners. Would allow drones to transport blood to patients suffering severe blood loss before they reach the hospital. Hospital officials say the drones could deliver blood in less than 3 minutes across many parts of the Hillsborough County area, which would allow first responders to begin transfusions sooner, because clearly the paramedics are not going to, I mean, they, you know, have a lot of, you know, medications and tools to provide immediate care, but they can't very well keep blood on hand in their, you know, rescue squads or whatever. So this would allow the paramedics, first responders, to begin transfusions right there on scene before they are even transported to the hospital the victims are. The pilot program is expected to begin in October if it receives approval from the Hillsborough County commissioners there in the Tampa area. And I can't imagine that it wouldn't, but I can see this being something that really catches on. Because why wouldn't it? I don't see a downside here. I mean, I'm sure that there are concerns. I'm sure that there's an argument, but off the top of my head, I can't see what the downside would be here. I think that is a fabulous idea, and why no one thought of that until now, I don't know, but pretty cool stuff. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories there to get your Thursday morning started.
Honoring the men and women of our military and first responder communities, American Warrior Radio, Sunday morning at 6 on WFIN.
Well, here's an interesting fact. Did you know that more than 50 million Americans, that's one in every seven people, receive care through community health centers, making them one of the nation's largest providers of affordable, comprehensive health care? More than 1,500 of these community health centers operate 17,000 service sites nationwide, often in areas where they are the only local source of primary care, behavioral health, dental care, and other essential services, regardless of a patient's ability to pay, and the demand continues to grow. In recognition of National Health Center Week, we are joined this morning by Angelique Wilkins. She is Executive Vice President of External Affairs and Chief Communications Officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers. And Angelique, we mentioned that figure of 50 million people, one in seven Americans. What is driving that need?
Simply put, what's driving the need for community health centers is lack. We know that one in three Americans lack reliable access to primary care. And fortunately, community health centers are meeting that need because they're built on a very simple but powerful idea. Everyone should have access to quality, affordable, effective primary and preventive care. Primary care is really the front door to health, and we like to look at it as our system has 17,400 welcome mats, and that's sites where people can access this affordable and trustworthy care. In Ohio, that's over a million patients that are getting their care from a community health center.
It is such an easy statement to make, and one that I think everyone would agree with, that you know, everybody deserves to have that access to that care. But as we have seen time and time again, it's easier said than done. For those who are not familiar with the community health center model, what exactly is a community health center, and you know, who can utilize these services?
Well, I'll start with the great news, which is that everyone can use a community health center. In fact, when community health centers were first created, they were called neighborhood health centers. And as you said, They make up the largest primary care system in this country with a workforce of more than 334,000 individuals that serve, you know, the 52.3 million patients. And we are the safety net that catches people when the rest of the system can't. The community health center model is built on three core simple principles. One, affordable, comprehensive, and effective care for all. Two, a whole person and whole community approach to care, because we know that care extends beyond the exam room. And they are patient governed. By mandate, 51% of community health center boards must be made up of patients from the community. That keeps these health centers accountable to the people that they serve, which is why it works.
Outside of the fact that they are often the only source of care, as we mentioned, and that they provide services regardless of a patient's ability to pay, what makes the community health center model unique, and how do they make a difference in the everyday lives of the people that they serve?
Well, community health centers, the difference is that they save lives and they save dollars. Primary care is about building relationships and trust, and localized neighborhood care fuels that trust. So our doors are always open. But health centers are innovators and healers and problem solvers, and they really take care of those that might be overlooked by our conventional healthcare system, like veterans. Over 434,000 receive their care from health centers, 10 million children, 4.4 million seniors. And we are delivering high quality primary care at a lower cost. Health center patients have 20% more primary care visits and 17% fewer hospitalizations. So that saves on downstream costs. They're economic drivers. They generate, as I said, almost 334,000 jobs. And they save Medicare and Medicaid money. Community health centers save Medicaid an estimated $1,400 per adult patient and $3,500 per dual eligible patient every year.
So as you are singing the praises of community health centers, and with good reason, what are you hearing from those on the front lines about the biggest challenges with respect to healthcare that Americans are facing right now, and by extension, the health center, community health centers are facing right now?
I think for Americans, it's access. You know, we need people. We need to help people find, you know, those 17,400 mats. We need to help them find the front doors of these health centers. And from the community health center perspective, it's a familiar set of pressures, like rising costs, difficulty finding, you know, labor and finding affordable medications. There's transportation barriers, and obviously we're all worried about losing coverage or access to care. And many of our patients are also struggling with those other outside the exam room factors, like housing instability, food insecurity, behavioral health needs that impact their health. But we stand firm and believe in community health centers are the best position to help these patients navigate these challenges, because they are right there. They've solved the access challenge. They're rooted in communities and neighborhoods. And that brings a sense of belonging that no matter what the challenge is, everyone should feel like they have a place where they can get care.
As we mentioned, this is National Health Center Week. What is the biggest message, the number one message that you want everyone to understand about community health centers, and the message that you are delivering to policymakers who kind of control the purse strings on this?
Absolutely, Chris. The key message is trust. That in a system that is often plagued with credibility issues, community health centers are one of the few shining parts of the health system that are working, that still earn trust by design, because those patients help govern them. And when we invest in community health centers, we are investing in healthier communities. National Health Center Week underscores that, you know, the future of the community health center movement is about expanding access, strengthening community partnerships, and continuing the mission, which is to deliver high quality care that's community driven and improved health for all.
Again, Angelique Wilkins is Executive Vice President of External Affairs and Chief Communications Officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers, National Health Center Week this week. Where can folks go to learn more or, again, to find a community health center location nearby?
NACHC.org. We have a very helpful Find a Health Center tool, and you can search by zip code, city, or state.
Angelique Wilkins, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Such an important component in addressing the issue of healthcare deserts in this country with some 17,000 sites nationwide. And it should be noted that while there are no community health center sites in Findlay, there are a number nearby, including Fostoria and Bowling Green, Tiffin, Lima, Kenton. And in fact, 92 of those sites within 50 miles of Findlay. We have a link on our webpage to learn more. Go to goodmornings.net. So yesterday, you may remember, we told you about a new survey from ABC News and Ipsos that finds a majority of parents with children K through 12 say that they expect to spend nearly $900 per child this year on items to get them ready to go back to the classroom. $900 per kid. And that is not helped by the fact that technology like tablets and laptops are no longer a luxury but a necessity for modern learning. And unless your child's school is furnishing one, which some do, you're going to notice that these tech devices are, in particular, are more expensive this year because of the high demand and short supply on components like processors and memory chips. Well, back in July of 2024, we spoke with CNET Money editor Dacia Milden about some of the ways that families can cut the cost of back to school down to size. It is today's Throwback Thursday. How are families keeping those costs in check? What are the top responses when you ask that?
Yeah, so the majority of shoppers are looking for coupons, sales, discounts. So that's right around 41%. Mm-hmm. And then we have another 39% that are comparing prices. So that's either in-store or online. They're seeing if they can find the best deal. And I'll throw just one more stat out here. We have a percentage of shoppers that are waiting to shop for those major sale moments. So looking for like those really big deals to see how they can, you know, get the best bang for their buck. So sales, all the way around, seeing how they can cut that cost.
And then, of course, a number of them are saying that we're just not buying as much stuff, but that only really takes you so far. I mean, there are some things that you're going to have to buy one way or the other, or get your hands on in one way or the other. And of course, it's the technology that really does. I mean, sure, the school supplies can add up, the clothes are expensive, but really it's the technology that's at the heart of this, right?
When we really start looking at just like what the most expensive back to school cost is, usually that's going to be around your technology. So your laptops, your tablets, even headphones, seeing that, you know, we have a lot of kids that are leaning on tech a little bit more than, you know, way back when.
Right.
So tech is expensive. Our CNET tech editor, Josh Goldman, he did share that a good laptop can cost between $700 and $1,000. So that right there alone tells you, hey, just to get a, you know, an average laptop can be pretty expensive.
Yeah. And again, whereas it used to a generation ago be maybe a luxury, now this has become a necessity. So what are some of the ways, some of the strategies to save on especially those big ticket items like that?
Number one, definitely look for a sale. So what we found from Prime Day is just looking for sales, looking to see where you can cut back and find some of the best deals. Definitely comparison shopping. So if you're going to definitely start by maybe looking at Target, maybe look at a few other places like a wholesale club. If you are looking at buying tech, you're going to want to make sure that you look for all your options. And when I say all the options, it means looking at some of that refurbished tech too. So you can check Back Market, Apple, Best Buy, eBay even has a refurbished market where you can maybe get some, a laptop that works perfectly fine, comes with a warranty, has a really good return policy, and you may just be paying a fraction of the cost just to get what you need for the school year.
So again, this is different than just buying used off of eBay or Facebook Marketplace. That's really the key when you're buying refurbished. You want to make sure that you're getting a good quality, professionally refurbished device.
Yes, absolutely. The best thing that you can do is check that warranty. Make sure you understand what's covered, what's not. If you get something in the mail that you're not necessarily happy on, you're going to want to make sure you check out that return policy too before you buy. That's a lot different than Facebook Marketplace, where you may not be able to return things as easily, of course. So just making sure that you check out some of the reputable refurbished sites before you buy any technology this school year.
Also, as we mentioned, the tax-free holiday in Ohio begins tomorrow. We actually have quite a generous one. It lasts a little over a week this year in the state of Ohio. Again, maximizing that opportunity to save a few bucks is going to be a key.
Definitely. And just making sure you keep looking at those sales too. Even if you're cutting sales tax, see how else you can cut.
You also bring up the point that many of these things will go through kind of like the sales cycle. It'll be on sale one week, not on sale the next week, and then on sale again. So, you know, these things do tend to come and go rather quickly.
Yeah, they do. So what I recommend for parents right now, if you're waiting for that sale or if it's coming up and maybe you're on the fence about buying it right now, of course, get the necessities first. Get what you know you're going to need to get through the first day or the first couple of weeks of school. And then maybe you'll revisit in a week or two, or maybe uniforms are on sale and you can get a few more beyond the first week of school. But one tip I have as a parent, check clearance. Back to school season does not last forever. You can even check in September to see if some of these items have even went on clearance, to even mark it down a little bit more. And you might not get the best pickings of everything, but just to get, you know, pencils, folders, things like that to get you through the school year, you can save a good bit there too.
That is a really good point, because they're going to need them all year long. So get them through this first month, and then you can start hitting some of those post back to school sales and save some money that way. And we mentioned those alternative payment options. Obviously, as we said, these expenses add up. It can be overwhelming. It can be really tempting to, you know, add to your debt load or use those buy now, pay later payment plans. What are the best strategies for not getting yourself into trouble in the process?
Number one, if you're going to take on buy now, pay later, make sure that you set your calendar reminders of when those payments are due. See if you can go ahead and have them automatically withdrawn from your account. You're going to want to make sure that you do not incur any fees, that you're not hurting your credit, and that you're just paying off those payments like on time and in full as much as you can. If you can pay them off early, that's great too. If you are leaning on a credit card, consider one with a zero APR offer for purchases. So that means you won't pay any interest for a certain amount of time. It depends on the card, of course. Those are usually for new credit cards, but if you are leaning on a credit card that's already in your wallet, make sure that if you don't plan to pay it off in full, that you have a plan to pay that off as soon as possible. Interest rates are really high right now, so putting together that repayment plan, paying it in full, just so you're not hitting yourself with a little bit more debt than you expected.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of money already. It can really get expensive if you add interest onto all of that. So some great advice there from CNET Money editor Daisha Milden for cutting that expense down to size. Thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And of course, all of that advice is even more important now, given the fact that the price of everything has gone up over the past couple of years. That from back in July of 2024, our conversation with CNET Money editor Daisha Milden about ways to cut the cost of back to school down to size. And one quick note, if you caught this, obviously a couple of years ago, the Ohio sales tax holiday was a full week long. And last year it was even longer than that. But this year, the sales tax holiday, which begins tomorrow, only runs through through the weekend. It is not a full week or longer. It is just the weekend. Begins tomorrow at midnight and runs through Sunday at midnight. So technically 12 a.m. Friday through 11:59 on Sunday. So if you're going to try and save yourself the tax, the sales tax on your kids' back to school stuff, you only have this weekend to do that this year. So just clarification there. We do have more information, more advice at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. Today's Throwback Thursday.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
A steakhouse in Hollywood, Florida is drawing attention for its unique dinner service. Class Soiree Steakhouse hosts clothing optional dinners on the first Monday of every month. Dining for nudists. The meal includes appetizers, surf and turf, and a champagne toast. The owner says the idea has been a hit and believes it is one of the only public dining experiences of its kind in the country. In case you're curious, tickets run $250 for men, $150 for women, and $300 for couples. No one under 18 is admitted, and the staff remains fully clothed. That gives a whole new meaning to the term dining al fresco, doesn't it? Do they serve strip steak? I'm just wondering. Alrighty then. Elsewhere in the broken news, in Mount Vernon, New York, Jennifer Lackard and her 20-year-old son Chase were both arrested at their home earlier this week on multiple charges, including attempted murder. Police say that Jennifer was the getaway driver after her son fired a gun near the Bronx Criminal Courthouse back in late June, aiming at a rival gang member. Fortunately, no one was killed. But here's the twist, and this is why this is worthy of the broken news. Jennifer Lackard is the now former Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety in Mount Vernon. She's the Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety, or she was. She has now been fired from her post. Yeah, I would say that's disqualify. If you're the getaway driver in a drive-by shooting, that probably disqualifies you as a Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety. I guess she could argue that nobody was killed, so there is that. But no, sorry. Go find another job. And finally, in the broken news this morning, crazy story, a decorative Civil War relic sitting on a Texas man's desk for years turned out to be a fully functional bomb. Steve Martin's son had found the 20-pound shell while fishing along the Guadalupe River, and the family assumed that it was a harmless replica. I don't know why you would assume that, but they assumed that, and so he had it sitting on his desk, even let visitors to his office pick it up and handle it. It was a delivery truck driver that happened to have military experience who eventually raised concerns, prompting Mr. Martin to contact the county sheriff's office just to find out. They, in turn, contacted an Air Force explosive ordnance team and confirmed it was a live parrot round, which is a type of artillery shell used by Union forces in the region over 150 years ago. A 150-year-old live shell from the Civil War. You think that was a little unstable? Maybe shouldn't have had people playing with it? The shell was removed and safely detonated at Camp Bullis over 50 miles away, said Mr. Martin, quote, "I thought it was really some sort of dummy, but it turns out I was the dummy." Quote, yeah, it's kind of a dumb thing to do. As a general rule of thumb, if I'm fishing out some military ordnance out of the river, I'm thinking that there might be a chance it's live. Just a word to the wise. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Findlay Trojans play here on WFIN. This is Tim Montgomery. Join me and Coach Cliff Hite for all the action of Trojan football. You'll get every exciting play each Friday night, all season long, home and away.
This is Coach Stephen Adams. The Trojans open the season at home Friday, August 21st with Medina.
The Trojans play here on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
Now for your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. And as screens become a bigger and bigger part of childhood, the average parent says that digital literacy education should start now before kindergarten. You got little kids at home, you got to teach them about having a healthy relationship with their devices. Specifically, according to a new survey of 2,000 parents of kids between, 5 years and younger. According to this survey, parents say specifically at age 4 is when we really need to focus on this. Age 4. Actually, maybe even a little bit before that, because parents say that their children start to become curious about technology like cell phones and smartwatches and tablets and computers around the age of 3 years old. They're becoming, it makes sense. I mean, we're on our devices all the time and kids become naturally curious about this. Even as toddlers, and as their curiosity around technology grows, 76% of parents in the survey say they find themselves trying to figure out how to teach responsible technology habits and doing this as they go. Now, kind of doing this on the fly, according to 3 out of 4 parents. Some parents will seek advice from others in their lives. 31% will look to their own parents, which may or may not be beneficial because, and we've talked about this before, this is technology that we never grew up with. So our parents didn't really have to do this to the extent that we have to, this generation of parents has to. So our own parents may provide some measure of a good example, but they've not really had to deal with when we were kids. So that may be of limited benefit. 24% of parents will turn to their friends for advice. How are you dealing with this with your kids? And 21% will ask their pediatrician. Another 21% say they consult with their child's teacher. So those might be resources you want to tap into. As to how they approach this, 43% of parents in the survey, and again, these are parents with kids under the age of 5 and under, 43% say they actively enforce screen time limits, with parents saying that they allow their kids to use technology for around 55 minutes a day on average. And again, these are the youngest kids. When they get older, it's harder to limit them to less than an hour a day, but to start, 55 minutes a day on average. 89% in the survey said that it is important that their children's screen time is educational. Now, that should be the primary use of technology at that age. But besides any educational or learning apps that many parents will use, 51% of parents also said that their child uses technology to watch videos. Even as toddlers, they'll be watching videos on their devices or on someone's devices, probably not their devices, but you get the idea. And 41% say that their kids use devices to listen to music, which I guess is to be expected because that's about the only way you listen to music these days, right? I mean, does anybody have CDs or records anymore? I mean, outside of as kind of a novelty. I mean, this is how we consume music. So if we want our kids to have music in their lives, we kind of have to get it on those devices. Even by kindergarten, 32% of parents say that their children are already using technology for school. So this is starting in preschool and kindergarten itself. They're using, one third of kids are using technology for school. And 20% of parents in the survey say that their kids are using technology for what they call phygital activities. Combination of physical and digital activities, phygital activities, which is a blend of offline, hands-on learning and digital elements. So blending all of this together, which that's probably a really good idea of a way to introduce kids to technology, not to replace physical activity, but to augment it. I like that. It's an interesting term. Phygital activities. 90% of parents in the survey, bottom line is this, 90% of parents do believe that teaching their children how to use technology will be important for their child's future. The only thing that struck me about that number is, who are the 10% of parents who don't think that teaching their children how to use technology will be important for their kids' future? I think that those 10% are probably burying their heads in the sand, but interesting stuff when it comes to children and technology, even at the youngest ages. Well, certainly you don't need me to tell you that feeding your family is getting more expensive every day, it seems. But lifestyle expert Justine Santinello is with us this morning with some ways to put dinner on the table without breaking the bank. And Justine, for all of those families who are struggling with these rising grocery prices, what tips do you have for shoppers to stretch those food dollars?
Yeah, and listen, I get it, guys. You know, I've got a family at home. I've got two kids. I'm in the supermarket weekly, sometimes multiple times a week.
Yeah.
Weeknight meals. So I really do get it. And I think that that's why ground pork has become the go-to protein in my house, because pork prices remain stable. They help me to stay on budget. It's predictable for me. But the biggest thing is, it's big flavor without those big prices.
So how do you prepare ground pork and bring out all of that flavor?
First of all, it's very easy to cook with, but I think the key is that you don't want to overcook it. So 160 degrees is your sweet spot. That's where you want it to be. So you're going to brown it on a medium high heat, let it caramelize a little bit, build that depth to it. And you have the option, if you want to really build layers of depth and aroma to what you're cooking, right? You could put some garlic, onion, shallots, you name it, in your pan first before you put your ground pork in. It's delicious. And you know, ground pork on its own is naturally flavorful. It has a lot of flavor. It's got a subtle sweetness. You've got those deep savory notes. It's juicy. It's tender. And it's very versatile to work with. You can use it in a lot of different flavor profiles, but also it's versatile in the ways you cook it. You can air fry it, sear it, roast it, bake it, grill it. I mean, you name it.
Yeah, a lot of different possibilities. And to that end, you have a couple of recipes to share, different ways that we can use pork. And first of all, here it says a maple pork burger with apple slaw. Tell us a little bit about this here.
So let me update it for you even further, right?
Okay.
I love maple pork burger, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to tell them about one that I like even better. Brown sugar pork burger.
Ooh.
Yum.
Okay.
And that little bit of that brown sugar against the naturally flavorful, that subtle sweetness that you get in the ground pork, delicious. And then you can put on top of it a bacon onion jam. Oh my goodness. I mean, this is so much flavor. You know, we're grilling more. You can use ground pork to make your burgers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this was just one example of a flavor profile, but you can do whatever floats your boat. Think of ground pork, though, when you're making and creating your burgers at home. Now, we also have a pasta fagioli, which I grew up eating in my Italian household. Love this. What I like about it is it's very impressive looking, but it only takes about 20 minutes to make, which is huge. It's got your beans in there, your pasta, the ground pork. It's very hearty, very flavorful. And then something really cool, my kids have really been like getting a real kick out of this lately. We call it an egg roll in a bowl. So okay. Essentially, it's like a deconstructed egg roll. And what I like is it's one pan. You know, I am all about what's quick, what's easy, less cleanup. That's one pan. And you've got flavors in there that maybe you're not using on a regular basis, right? Like sesame oil or soy sauce. You put some sesames on top, some fresh green onion. You've got cabbage in there, peppers. Yum, yum, yum. I mean, these are three very different examples with a lot of flavor. But listen, guys, I get it. Not everybody necessarily loves to cook or is their best at it. You can still use ground pork in your most simple recipes that you're making anyway, right? So like pasta with meatballs, use your ground pork for your meatballs.
Yep.
Or taco night. We do taco night every single week at my house. You can use ground pork. And then, you know, if you really want to go outside the box, my daughter is obsessed with pork dumplings.
Some really great ideas there. And I love the idea of, you know, putting a little spin, a different spin on some stuff that maybe you're used to, trying something different that looks more fancy and complicated than it actually is. Everybody loves those kinds of recipes. Where do we get those recipes and more ideas?
Go to tastewhatporkcando.com. They've all right. got all the info for you guys there, but also a ton of recipe ideas.
All right. We will link that up on our webpage as well. Got some great ideas for your dinner table this evening. And lifestyle expert Justine Santinello with us this morning. Justine, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, which is goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. We thank you for that. A quick note. There will be no podcast tomorrow or Monday or Tuesday, as we're taking a little extra time off, a little mini vacation for my birthday over the weekend. So happy birthday to me. When we get back on Wednesday's program, the Humane Society and SPCA of Hancock County recently took in more than a dozen dogs in an animal cruelty case. What is the process for rescuing abused and neglected animals, and what happens to those animals after? So until Wednesday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day, a great extended weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.